The gunshots echo across the farmland. At first, some think they're firecrackers. The idea doesn't really make sense, though, because why would anyone be doing that so early on a Sunday morning? Humans are weird, though, right? They do strange things. Terrible things, sometimes. Soon, the popping sounds are joined by screams. Not of joy or excitement, but unabated terror. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 188, The Uster Family Massacre. This episode is sponsored by the brand new release movie, Sharp Corner. When the McCall family move into their new home, they're sure that this will be the family home that makes all their dreams come true. But those dreams quickly turn into nightmares when a tricky section of road right in front of their house starts to claim lives in tragic car accidents. Josh McCall, played by Ben Foster, soon becomes obsessed with saving the lives of these people, and that obsession threatens to pull him and his family into a darkness they may never escape from. Director Jason Buxton expertly crafts some seriously psychologically complex characters in Sharp Corner. Honestly, it's been a long time since I've been a little creeped out by just the energy given off by a character in a trailer for a movie. So, this one looks like it's a must-watch. Also starring Kobe Smulders and Gavin Dreher, Sharp Corner launches in cinemas nationwide today, the 27th of June. So get down to your closest cinema or book your tickets online for the weekend right now. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Pakama Mukhole, Beverly Wood, Tanya Kors, and Lee Anan for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. Although family murders remain a pretty infrequent crime, it does feel like recently they've become more and more common. I've often wondered if that has something to do with increasing stress levels or a poor economy. But when I was researching today's case, one of the experts providing commentary mentioned something which struck a chord. He said that family murders have been happening for as long as there has been recorded history. One of the oldest recorded familicides in modern history occurred in London in 1802, when George Forster killed his wife and child by drowning them in the Paddington Canal. But there are descriptions of incidents going back all the way to ancient Greek and Roman times, which, although not called familicides, because the language for that simply didn't exist then, they certainly resemble what we now call those crimes in description. Of course, knowing that they've always happened doesn't make it any easier. Crimes like these are still incredibly devastating and have far-reaching effects. Ordinarily, familicides usually target those in the immediate family, but I think that's usually just a matter of proximity. And in this case, with victims from a range of extensions of the family, that does seem to show that to be true. In researching this case, I used several media articles, some academic resources related to familicide crimes, and an episode of Haeskinwit's Vlees en Bloed series. So, let's get into episode 188, the Eustace Family Massacre.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Johnny and Elmine Eustace met and married in the late 1980s. They had their first daughter, whose name has been withheld in most publications, in 1987. At that time, Johnny was in the South African National Defence Force, where he remained for a few years before leaving and taking up work as a security guard in a large security firm. His background in the army stood him in good stead in his new chosen career, and he received additional training through this company and was trained and qualified to work with firearms. During this time with the company, he was assigned to several different posts, depending on where he was needed. And for the most part, he seemed to shine as a hard-working individual who took his job seriously. He and Almin's marriage, according to her mother, was also stable and happy in the early years. And in 1994, they welcomed another child together, this time a son they named Blake. And 3 years after that, another little boy they named Sanjay. When Johnny had been working these various security posts, the Eustace family had lived on the Cape Flats. But Almin, in particular, longed for her children to experience the life she and her siblings had had growing up on farms at the foot of the Kouebokkeveld Mountains. Almin and her siblings had come from a long line of individuals who'd worked farms in the Western Cape. Her sisters still lived on one of the farms her family had worked for years, in Prince Alfred Hamlet. In my previous life, I had a client I visited on one of the farms in Prince Alfred Hamlet. And it's literally one of those towns that if you blink for too long while driving through, you'll miss the heart of it. But a lot of the real community that happens in towns like that actually happens on the farms and between the farms. Farm owners know their neighbours, and by the same token, all the employees and residents of the farms know their neighbours too. This type of connection and community is always a wonderful feeling, but it's also very beneficial in times of need and emergency. Omia, the farm on which Almin's sisters lived and prior generations of her family had worked, was owned by Hutlesh van der Merwe. His family had been on the farm in various iterations over almost 11 generations. He also acknowledges how those who are employed on the farm also often come from the same families who've worked on the land for years. So when a security guard post became available on the farm in 1999, He asked Almin's sisters whether anyone in their family had the right experience for the post. Of course, they immediately thought of their brother-in-law, Johnny Yuster. In the months that followed, Johnny, Almin, and the three children moved to the farm, and Johnny worked as a security guard there. Fundamava was always very happy with Johnny's work and liked him as a person too. The Yuster family seemed to be doing well, but being in close quarters with his wife's family, according to Johnny, began to be quite poisonous for his marriage. Johnny claims that when he and Almin would argue, his sisters-in-law would get involved and make things worse. Now, I will just say that we have no one else's view of this claim, because the only people left to talk at the end were children, who wouldn't really have had a good understanding of the adult dynamics going on around them. Either way, it seemed that the relationship was in a very rocky period, and divorce was being discussed. He claimed his in-laws were threatening to help Almin to take the children away from him and ensure he never saw them again. Whether this atmosphere led to the behaviour that followed is really unknown, but I'm sure it had created a pressure cooker of sorts. Johnny's job as a security guard at the farm would come to an end when he was involved in an altercation with another farm worker. There's very little information about exactly what happened, but the disagreement was allegedly about drugs. None of the sources confirm whether it was Johnny or the other farm worker, or both, who were in possession of the drugs, or what drugs they were. It would later be revealed that Johnny was a cannabis user. Either way, this altercation led to Johnny pulling out his loaded gun and pointing it in the face of the farm worker. The situation eventually de-escalated, but a complaint was laid and Fundamava asked Johnny to leave the farm. Johnny, Almin, and the children moved back to Cape Town, and he quite quickly got a job as a security guard in town. With the family now separated from the apparently toxic environment at the farm, one would think that things would have gotten better. But there were clearly still deep rifts in the relationship, which seemed to have nothing to do with Almin's family. In February 2000, Almin's sister, Sophia, who was a pastor at a church along with her husband, Barent, invited Almin and her family to the farm for the weekend for a get-together. Almin and the children were excited to be able to spend time on the farm again, but Johnny insisted he was not going with them. Almin seemed to really want her husband to go with them, or perhaps she was concerned that he would refuse to let the children go if he didn't go, and so she spent several days convincing him to accompany them. She reminded him that he still had quite a few items he needed to collect at the farm, which they'd left there when they moved. This included a small gun safe, which contained the gun he'd used for his security work on the farm. Johnny eventually relented and agreed to accompany her. They left for the farm early on Saturday, the 19th of February. The church event at the farm that day was well attended, and everyone seemed to enjoy themselves. Johnny was brooding, though, and as the visitors started to leave, the atmosphere became more and more tense. He claims that his sisters-in-law had been throwing negative comments his way the entire day. Johnny said that one of the comments that hurt him the most was about his appearance. His complexion was apparently darker than that of his wife's family, and he said that throughout the years, the women had referred to him with a racial slur. In addition to this, he said that the family began reminding him that they were going to help Almin to divorce him and ensure he had no custody or visitation with his children. It's incredibly difficult in situations like this to take any claim like this at face value. The story is being presented by someone who, at the time of the telling, was in a situation in which he needed to look like the wronged party. And as I've said before, we have absolutely nothing from the other side to counter this. Ordinary, toxic family dynamics aside, it seems strange that an entire family would pack themselves up against one individual with no reason at all. There's also never been any explanation about why the relationship was headed for divorce anyway. As Saturday wore on, Johnny went for walks on the farm and smoked dacha. The family settled in for the night, but he was upset and restless. Early on Sunday morning, he got up and started to set about collecting the belongings he'd left behind at the farm, including the gun safe with the loaded firearm in it. Two young boys, boys at the time, but young men, as they spoke to the Hayskenwood film crew, who were the sons of Elmin's sisters, explained how they'd woken up that morning, and Sophia had made them cereal for breakfast. By 10 a.m., the sun was already baking down on the farm, and the two boys, Dave D. and Alfredo, decided they wanted to go swimming down at the farm's dam. Their cousins, Sanjay and Blake, Johnny and Almin's sons, wanted to go with. But as they started walking down the road to the dam, they saw Johnny walking toward them. He had the small gun safe tucked under his arm, and he addressed his sons, telling them they could not go with their cousins, as the family were going to get ready to leave for home. The disappointed boys said goodbye to their cousins, and Dave D. and Alfredo continued on down to the dam to swim, while the young boys followed their father back up to the house. Johnny Huster would later claim to have only fractional memories about the events that followed, although he claimed that it was definitely more verbal abuse from his sisters-in-law that had sparked the alleged fury that overtook him, he couldn't say exactly what had been the proverbial straw that had broken the camel's back. What we do know is that Johnny had taken the gun out of the safe and ensured it was fully loaded with ammunition. He'd also had additional ammunition in his pocket. Then, without warning, he began shooting members of his and his wife's family. He started shooting inside the house and then moved outside before going back into the house to continue shooting those who had survived. Only two of the victims Johnny killed that day were found inside the house, Jeanette Jacobs and Cornelia Fasaki. Everyone else was killed as they attempted to flee from Johnny. When the initial shots went off inside the house, the two boys who'd been swimming at the dam immediately knew what they were hearing. They stood frozen to the spot for a moment, the heat of the day suddenly replaced by an icy chill in their veins. Slowly, they crept up the embankment and moved through the orchard, keeping themselves hidden until they could see the house. The scene of horror came into view just in time for them to see their uncle Johnny shoot his own two sons, Sanjay and Blake. Both boys collapsed immediately. A single shot to each of their heads, cold-bloodedly ending their lives. They then watched, their hands clasped over their mouths to muffle the sound of their own sobs, as Sophia ran toward Johnny, screaming that God would punish them for what he'd done. Johnny turned and, without a word, shot the woman in the head. Her husband, Barnes, who'd been running behind her, was shot next. At the corner of their eye, the boys had seen Almeen, bleeding from a shot to her stomach and half bent over, running into the orchard and toward the road. Johnny Yuster followed her. The two boys sped off through the orchards, heading for the next farm over to get help. They planned to stay away from the road just in case they ran into Johnny, but as they neared it, a glance down it showed them that Johnny had hunted Almeen down, and her now still body was riddled with bullets, lying in the road. They backed into the cover of the trees, tears pouring down their cheeks, and stayed focused on reaching the next farm. Although they never actually measured the distance between the two farms, it was undoubtedly many kilometers that the two boys had run that day before they finally reached safety. By the time they did, others had already alerted neighbors, and the boys were welcomed into consoling arms. The news that both their mothers had been murdered would only reach them later. After Johnny Yuster emptied his gun into his wife on that farm road, he headed for a farm worker riding a tractor nearby. He held the man at gunpoint and demanded his two-way radio. The man handed it over and then watched as Yuster fled into the mountains. Fundamava sprang into action the minute he received a notification about the terrifying event that had taken place on the farm. While police and ambulances raced to the scene, he got to work trying to reach Johnny Yuster on the two-way radio. He wasn't sure what he'd say to the young man, but he figured if he could just keep him talking, he could try to ensure he stayed within reach of the police. He did eventually get hold of Yuster. The man told him he didn't really want to talk, but if the police wanted him to hand himself over, they had to leave a charged cell phone with call time on it in a designated spot. He wanted to be able to speak with his mother, he said, and explain to her what he'd done. In the meantime, paramedics and police descended on the employees' farmhouses and began to treat survivors. In all, police found 7 deceased victims. They were Almeen Yuster and her sons, Sanjay and Blake, Almeen's sisters, Cornelia, Janetta, and Sophia, and Sophia's husband, Barent. Almeen and Johnny's teenage daughter had been shot by her father, but she made a full recovery from her injuries. 2 other bystanders had been injured in the fray, including farm workers not related to the family who tried to intervene and stop Johnny. Forensic technicians spent hours at the scene collecting evidence and photographing bullet casings, the positioning of the victims' bodies, and blood evidence. The terrible news began to spread through the community, and Almeen's elderly mother would be given the horrific confirmation that she had lost 3 daughters, a son-in-law, and 2 grandchildren in the blink of an eye. It did not take very long for an enormous manhunt to be set in motion for Johnny Yuster. Residents of Prince Alfred Hamlet were warned to stay indoors until police were able to apprehend the armed and dangerous individual. Cousins Dave D. and Alfredo recalled how terrified they were that night. They were with extended family and felt certain that Johnny could come back to finish what he'd started. Everyone in the community had a fitful night's sleep, with adults taking turns to keep watch and fathers barricading their families' front doors with pieces of furniture. All the while, Johnny Yuster moved through the Coobokkerveld Mountains that he knew so well. Occasionally, he would turn the radio on and tell whoever was on the other side that he could see their search efforts. By then, the army had deployed soldiers to help search. Helicopters hovered overhead, and dog units searched the ground. Eusta was essentially taunting the searchers, telling them that he could see them, but they couldn't see him. This meant that all of the searchers on the mountain that day were in grave danger. If he was watching and he was still armed, he could kill any one of them at any moment. Eventually, it was determined that the danger factor was just too high, and the search was called off for the night. In the morning, the family members Dave D. and Alfredo were staying with decided not to send them to school. The boys had wanted the comfort of familiarity and their friends to talk to. Children grieve differently from adults and can often only process small amounts of their grief at once before they must return to ordinary life to be able to move through the terrible experience they face. It can often seem strange to adults, as though the child doesn't quite comprehend what they're experiencing. But for the most part, they do. They just cannot stay submerged in grief for as long as adults can, and their grieving process works differently. But the adults insisted that it was far too dangerous, and until Johnny Eusta had been apprehended, they would not go anywhere without close supervision. This decision would prove very wise, as the rest of the day played out in Prince Alfred Hamlet and its surrounds. At the school both boys attended, Skierverbach Secondary School, that morning a man sat underneath a large bush, just on the edge of the school grounds. He watched as children, teachers, and the principal walked in and out of the school during the morning. He also watched as a few hundred meters down the road, a temporary police command center, which had been set up to centralize the search for Johnny Eusta, buzzed with activity. Policemen walked past the man and paid him no heed. They figured he was just another resident of the town. Later, the surviving boys would wonder whether it was really a coincidence that that particular bush on the school grounds had been chosen. They and their friends would sit there at break time almost every day. Just after 11:30 a.m., the man stood up and walked into the school. He walked past the protesting school receptionist and straight into the principal's office. R.B. Klink recognized Johnny Eusta immediately, and he shrunk back in his chair, wondering whether Eusta had come there to claim further victims. Eusta told Klink that he was there to hand himself over. He put one hand in the air and said he was going to remove his firearm from his waist. Klink watched in horror as Eusta placed the gun on his desk and slid it over to him, warning him to be careful with it because it was loaded. Klink kept one eye on Eusta and carefully pulled the gun toward him, opening the top drawer of his desk and placing the weapon inside before locking it and placing the key in his pocket. Eusta then sat down in a chair and told Klink he could phone the police to arrest him, and he should please tell them that he was no longer armed. I briefly wondered why Johnny Eusta would have handed himself over to the principal of a school rather than going just a few hundred meters up the road and handing himself over to police. Of course, there's always the possibility that he'd really gone there that day to kill Dave D. and Alfredo. We'll never know that for sure. But I think what is more likely is that, although he had taken seven lives and almost taken another three, Johnny Yoster really didn't want to be shot by police. He wanted to live. And he knew that even one wrong move from him in handing himself over to police directly could result in them shooting him. It was self-preservation in the end. Within minutes of Klink making a call to police, officers swarmed the principal's office. Bewildered schoolchildren were locked down in classrooms, just in case things went wrong. But Johnny Yoster calmly stood when told to, put his hands behind his back, and allowed police to cuff him and take him into custody. News spread that the mass murderer had been apprehended, and everyone who'd been on tenterhooks from the night before heaved a sigh of relief. In the days that followed, the communities of and surrounding Prince Alfred Hamlet began to prepare for some of the largest funeral events they'd ever witnessed. Close to 2,000 people descended upon the farm for a memorial service for all seven victims. And then two separate funeral services would be held, in which Almin and her two sons were buried together, and then her sisters and Barent were laid to rest in a separate service. The families linked to the victims were completely devastated. A teenage girl, left as the sole survivor of one family. Other children, left without a mother, and some without either parent. An entire community, completely aghast at how a seemingly mild-mannered man could turn into a mass murderer in a moment. While so many grieved and tried to find a new way to move forward in their lives, Johnny Yoster was charged with 7 murders and 3 attempted murders. He did not apply for bail and was sent for psychiatric assessment. Dr. Sean Kaliski, a vastly experienced psychiatrist at Falkenberg Hospital, would later deliver the results of this assessment. Yoster, he said, was fit to stand trial, and he'd also not suffered from any mental health conditions at the time of his crime, which would have impaired his ability to determine right from wrong. Rather, he said that the crime was evidence of a general lack of internal control found among South Africans, and also of the culture of aggression that made South Africans feel that they had to respond aggressively to any taunt. Yoster had decided that killing 7 people, including his own wife and children, was a fair equivalent to make up for the taunting and verbal abuse he claimed to have suffered at the hands of his wife's family. He had not been, as many mass murderers and family annihilators are, suicidal at the time of his crime, and taking his own life had seemingly never even crossed his mind. He just decided that he would no longer take the abuse he'd claimed to suffer, and felt that if he was going to kill his wife and her sisters, then he should also kill his children, so they did not have to live without their parents. What would become a pretty important part of this case, though, and the eventual sentencing decision, was that there didn't appear to have been any premeditation to the murders. Even though Dave D. and Alfredo had testified that they had seen Johnny playing with his gun the night before, Yoster insisted that he had not intended to kill anyone until the moment he'd raised his gun and fired the first shot. Of course, it could have been argued that every murder after that point was premeditated, because he had quite literally hunted his victims down and could have stopped after he'd killed the first person. Ultimately, that would not be the way the court saw it. After several postponements, Yoster pled guilty to 7 charges of murder, but the 3 charges of attempted murder were withdrawn. The state was apparently uncertain that they would be able to prove intent, and also did not see the value in pushing for a full trial for 3 attempted murder charges when Yuster was already pleading guilty to 7 much more serious charges. The judge accepted this and found Yuster guilty. The sentencing, which came shortly after, was delivered by Judge Desai in a measured and considered manner. Desai said, quote, "No sentence I can give you will ever exceed the painful experience of killing your family. The last moments of your loved ones will stay with you for the rest of your life. Whatever can be said in your favour, I cannot lose sight of the fact that you have the potential to cause harm to people on this scale. The community needs protection, and I need to balance the scales again." End quote. Judge Desai said that he did not feel that life sentences would have been appropriate for the crime, saying, quote, "7 human beings were killed in a senseless and gruesome fashion. The sentence of this court must reflect this. But it wasn't a crime committed out of greed, like the murders we see in this court every day. These murders had a very specific and unique context." End quote. Yuster was sentenced to 7 terms of 20 years imprisonment for each of the people he killed. 17 years of each of those 20-year sentences were ordered to run concurrently, while 3 years would not. This made up an effective total of 38 years imprisonment. While the families of the victims were not happy with the sentence, they were grateful that the trial was over and they could get on with grieving their loved ones. Over the years, Dave D. and Alfredo did their best to honour the memories of their mothers. They were both raised by family, and although they said they didn't lack for love and support, the specific type of love that comes from a mother was stolen from them on the day Johnny Yuster committed his crimes. Although many of the family members said that they would have preferred life sentences for Yuster, I'm pretty sure that at that time they were probably under the impression that he would serve those 38 years in prison. Unfortunately, as we know, this is not the case, especially not with determinate sentences. Johnny Yuster became eligible for parole halfway through that sentence, at 19 years in 2019. He was not released at that first parole consideration, but he was released at the next consideration, 2 years later, in 2021. Shockingly, it seems that either only some, or at least definitely not all, of the secondary victims of this crime were advised of his release, nor were they given the opportunity to participate in the parole proceedings. I say this because Dave D., the son of Cornelia Fisahi, walked into a braai event one night, only to find himself face to face with his mother's murderer. He had no idea that the man was even eligible for parole, never mind that he'd been released. Dave D. was dumbstruck, and then completely horrified, as he says, Johnny Yuster smiled broadly, slapped him on the shoulder, and proceeded to chat and ask him questions about his life, like absolutely nothing had happened. Dave D. turned around and walked out of the event without uttering a word to Johnny. He then phoned Alfredo and warned him not to go near the event and delivered the terrible news that they hadn't seen coming. In all fairness, even if Johnny Huerster had been given life sentences instead of the determinate sentences, he would still have been eligible for parole in 2025 at the latest. Actually, possibly even sooner than that, because he was sentenced prior to 2004. But it's unlikely he would have been released on his first parole hearing, as he was not in any case. And then he at least would have had to have waited until 2027 for his next hearing and possible release. That would have at minimum have brought him to having served 27 years for 7 murders. As it stands, he served just 3 years for each life that he took. And regardless of his motive, or how many insults he endured from his sisters-in-law, if at all, I cannot see how that is justice. Above all of this, no son of a murder victim should have to walk into an event and find his mother's murderer there when he thought he was behind bars. Because no one thought to tell him that the man had been released. Alfredo says that he's glad he hasn't come across Johnny Huerster yet, because he's not sure how he would react. He's married now, and has children of his own. And if there's any lesson he's taken from his mother's murder, it's to ensure that his anger never gets the best of him. He's known since the moment he hid in that orchard with his cousin, witnessing unspeakable things, that anger is the most destructive of emotions. A moment of unabated rage can rip through multiple generations, changing lives along the way and opening up wounds that will never heal. And while he has forgiven Johnny Huerster for being incapable of handling his own rage all those years ago, he certainly hasn't forgotten. And he wonders whether there might be a part of him where that kind of rage might live too. Where, if he sees the man who ripped away 7 lives without so much as a thought, he too might be capable of almost anything. When I wrote my book, Sizzlers, about the mass murder of 9 men and an attempted murder of a 10th in Sea Point in 2003, I spoke about that offender's parole journey and how, despite having 9 life sentences, he too is being considered for parole. I do see considerable differences between these 2 crimes and these 2 offenders. But I, like the families of the victims, struggle with the idea that someone can take so many lives for any selfish reason, whether it's greed or retribution, and only serve such a short period in the relative scheme of things. And can someone really be rehabilitated when they show such disregard for the feelings of one of their victim's sons, to not even offer an apology, but rather to completely gloss over the fact that he's suddenly standing on the wrong side of a set of prison doors, and flippantly ask how things have been going? Like you're just shooting the breeze at the bar with your buddies. Is there any true self-awareness there? Any true empathy? And without self-awareness and empathy, is a mass family murderer really rehabilitated? Almin Huerster, Blake Huerster, Sanjay Huerster, Cornelia Fasaki,
Sophia Swartz, Barent Swartz, and Janetta Jacobs. Rest gently.
If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.